Now, where we stopped, I think one of the last main points was I was explaining what are the components of GDP, and relating GDP to the money supply by way of velocity. And I pointed out GDP is currently around 11.7 trillion. If you take the money supply as 2.7 trillion, that's a velocity of 4.3. But you should realize that GDP by no means includes the totality of spending in the economic system. There is a lot of spending that does not enter into GDP. First of all of the spending for raw materials, payrolls, so-called intermediate products. What goes into GDP, for example, would be the money spent to buy bread and automobiles, but not the money spent by the bakers to buy flour, or by the flour millers to buy wheat, or the payrolls of these operations. So GDP, with the exception of business, plant, and equipment spending, is final product. It excludes what may be a much larger sum of spending, the sum of payrolls and the spending for all the intermediate goods. GDP does not count spending for real estate. It does not count the spending for stocks and bonds, which every day there's a couple of billion shares perhaps traded at some substantial average price. So all of this spending is not counted in GDP. A measure of total spending of all kinds sometimes has the name total transactions. And it would have a much, much higher velocity measure. If the total spending of all descriptions were perhaps $100 trillion in a year, and we still have the same $2.7 trillion money supply, well, the corresponding velocity would be that $100 trillion of spending divided by 2.7. That would be 30-something times. That velocity would be over 30. So there are different possible measures of velocity corresponding to different measures of total spending. The velocity measure that goes with GNP, or GDP, is typically referred to as income velocity. A more logical name would be GDP velocity, but it's called income velocity because it's very, very close to national income. All right, now I want to turn as fast as I can to the subject, the monetary system and banking. And the first topic is standard money, which can be either commodity money or fiat money. Standard money is that money which, when you get it, you are fully and finally paid. It's not a claim to anything beyond itself. Under a gold standard, the standard money would be gold, coin, or bullion. Under a gold standard, there could be paper money, but the paper money is not the standard money. It would be a claim to the gold. The standard money would be the gold on a gold standard. On our present monetary system, essentially this stuff is the standard money. This is not a claim to anything further. When you get this, this is full and final payment. So the standard money is very, very close. The overwhelming component is the paper currency. There's another significant element. The deposits of member banks of the Federal Reserve System, they're checking deposits with the Federal Reserve. The reason for counting that is if the Federal Reserve if someone has a checking deposit with the Federal Reserve, the Federal Reserve also prints this stuff or is responsible for its printing. And so whatever they owe in the way of checking deposits is equivalent to currency. So we can count Federal Reserve checking deposits with the Federal Reserve. We can view that as a component of standard money. These two together represent what is called the monetary base. You can think of the monetary base and standard money as almost interchangeable concepts. The main components, by far the major component, is the currency. Then there is the reserves of the member banks, which in large part consists of further currency, currency that we didn't count as part of currency in circulation, the currency that's held in the vaults of the member banks of the Federal Reserve System. And there are a couple of other elements, the deposits of the International Monetary Fund, the U.S. Treasury. All in all, at the present time, as estimated by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, the monetary base is is roughly $783 billion. That is overwhelmingly currency. Currency is about $685 billion. There's another $42 billion or so representing reserves of the banks. So this monetary base can be taken as representing the standard money, the money which, when you get it, represents full and final payment. Now, the reason for going into standard money is that most of the money supply is not standard money. Most of that part of the money supply which is not standard money represents claims to standard money. I have a concept here, fiduciary media, in point three. Fiduciary media are claims to standard money, payable on demand by the depositor, or the holder of the claim, and accepted in commerce as the equivalent of standard money, but for which no standard money actually exists. That's fiduciary media. Transferable claims to standard money, payable on demand, accepted in commerce as the equivalent of standard money, but for which no standard money actually exists. Now, what's the overwhelmingly most important example? Checking deposits. If you recall what a check says on its face, on that first line, I think it says, pardon me? Pay to the order of. And what are you ordering to be paid? Well, you're ordering standard money to be paid. You're saying pay to Jack Smith however many dollars. You're ordering the bank to transfer part of your deposit to him. Now, your deposit at a bank is a claim to standard money. If it's a checking deposit, it's payable on demand. All you have to do is walk in to the bank at which you have your funds on deposit, and you can say, pay me the proceeds of my deposit. Now, you don't have to collect it yourself. You can transfer the deposit to someone else. Now, that's what you do when you write a check. What you've got, what your deposit is a claim to standard money, payable on demand, but what's particularly important is it's a transferable claim.
It's a transferable
claim to standard money. So your checking deposit is a claim to standard money. It's a claim essentially to currency. It's payable at your pleasure, on your demand. But for most of these claims, there is no actual standard money in the possession of the banks. So we have this concept of fiduciary media, which is transferable claims for which there is no standard money actually existing. Now, well, I brought up something that's a little bit out of date here. Let me go back to the previous view, and maybe I can get something more current. Well, I know I have a spreadsheet file. Let me see if I can find that and bring that back up. Here we go. Okay. In August of this year, the total money supply was $2,694 billion. And the currency in circulation is on the order of $685 billion. I'll enlarge this a bit. Okay. Now, what that means is we have total checking deposits of a little over $2 trillion, $2,009 billion. And against these checking deposits, the banks have reserves of about $42 billion. Now, where did I get the number for reserves? Well, that's part of that same page where we got M1 from. Hopefully, I still have that available. Okay, here we are. We have, and this figure is published every Friday, we have an item, total reserves. Can you guys see this? $42,426 billion. That's total reserves in the banking system as of the 2 weeks ended August 18th. Now, these reserves consist in large part in currency in the bank's own vaults. That's called vault cash. And for the rest, it's deposits that the banks have with the Federal Reserve banks. So Bank of America possibly might have $500 million in currency in its system, and maybe another $500 million in a deposit with the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. The Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco. That would be $1 billion out of these $42 billion plus of reserves. And we do the same thing for every other bank that's a member of the Federal Reserve System. And the grand total is $42 billion plus. That's further standard money. Now, when we subtract that remaining standard money from the checking deposits, we're left with $1,967 billion. And this represents the fiduciary media. This is the amount of fiduciary media. This is the amount of claims to standard money payable on demand by the depositors, transferable claims, claims against which they can write checks, but for which there is no actual standard money. Well, what is there if there isn't standard money? The banks have assets. But what's the nature of their assets? Debt. It's other people's debts. So they have that. Now, what sorts of, what could you say about this in a little more detail? They have, some of their assets are mortgage loans. Others might be government securities. They may have different IOUs. On various types of loans. They have marketable securities, most of which are fixed income type securities. I don't think they have any significant stock holdings, if any. So they've got various securities and customers' IOUs. Now, what I have here is an illustration of, you could take it as an illustration either of a bank or of the whole banking system. And we've got assets over on the left, liabilities on the right. I'm showing standard money reserves of $42 billion. Checking deposits, I hope the number squares with what I arrived at a little while ago. I'm taking the checking deposits as $1,987 billion. They have loans and investments of $1,975 billion. And they have bank premises. That's another one of their assets. You add up the grand total of the assets, we have $2,022 billion, a little over $2 trillion. And the liabilities are equal. But only a very small part of this is capital and surplus, $35 billion. Now, what happens if something occurs that reduces the value of the assets of a bank or the banking system? Let's deal with a bank first. Suppose you have a bank that has a significant number of mortgage loans in its portfolio, and some of the debtors are unable to continue their payments. So they've stopped making payments on their mortgages. Yeah? Well, the bank, if the payments are not made good in a fairly short time, the bank can foreclose on the mortgage. But if this is any kind of significant development, what do you think will be the price at which they'll have to liquidate the assets against which they issued the mortgages?
Less than
long. There'll be a drop in price, and the banks could very well suffer a loss on that item. And to the extent that the value of their assets would be reduced by such a development, what's the effect on the capital and surplus? That's equivalently reduced. So would it take, if we view this as an individual bank, suppose we were stating this not in thousands of billions, but suppose we took it as 1987 million, that's a good size bank, almost $2 billion in checking deposits. How much of a drop percentage-wise in the assets in the loan and investment portfolio would it take to wipe out such a bank's capital and surplus? I would think, on the order of 20%, that would certainly do it. If the capital and surplus is 35, it should be even less than that. 10% would be 197.5. 2%, it seems like. If the assets fell just 2%, 1% is 19.75 billion. 2% would be 39.5 billion. That would wipe out the capital and surplus and create a deficit of over $4 billion. So the banks are very, very highly leveraged, and a relatively small decline in the assets of a given bank is capable of wiping out its capital and surplus. Now, what happens if there is a bank that ends up in this position? And historically, this has happened on many occasions. Imagine that it's Friday afternoon, you're thinking of picking up your dry cleaning. Had you gone there, you would have written a check, paid for the dry cleaning, and walked out with it. But you can't make it to the cleaners, you figure, okay, you'll wait till Monday afternoon, or Monday evening. But when you wake up Monday morning, it turns out that the bank at which you have your checking deposit has been closed. The examiners have found that the assets are deficient. The bank has no capital and surplus. If the dry cleaner reads the same news story that you do, do you think you'll be able to write him a check Monday evening?
No.
Now, until Monday, your deposits were the equivalent of money. We'd count them as part of the money supply. But what's happened when the bank fails? What's the effect on the money supply? What was regarded as the equivalent of standard money has lost that character. It has the status of a highly speculative junk security. What would a deposit at a failed bank be worth? You might find someone willing to take it over from you, but it would be pennies on the dollar. If a bank fails, its assets will have to be liquidated, and the depositors will only collect less than 100 cents on the dollar, and who knows when. So this part of the supply of fiduciary media loses its character as the equivalent of money. It loses its character as part of the money supply. So what's the effect on the quantity of money? The quantity of money is correspondingly reduced. Now, if you keep in mind the quantity theory of money, what should we expect to be the effect on the volume of spending to this extent? That will go down. Now, if this is any kind of significant bank, I mean, if it were a tiny itty-bitty bank in Podunk, it might have no perceptible effects. But suppose it's a fairly significant bank, what's going to be, and it has some impact on the volume of spending, what's going to be the effect on business sales revenues and profit margins?
Reduced.
That'll be reduced. And what is the effect of that on such businesses to keep current on their debts? They may have greater difficulty. And so there's the potential there, when you have a very, very highly leveraged banking system like this, if some significant bank failures occur, serving to reduce the quantity of money, and then cutting the volume of spending, and thus sales revenues, cash flows, and thus the ability to repay debts, that can cause more business failures, which in turn causes more bank failures, with what further effect on the quantity of money?
A further decrease.
And this represents, this is the way in which the quantity of money can actually fall, and in which you have an actual deflation. Now, exactly this process is what occurred in the Great Depression, starting in October of 1929, and running throughout the 30s. I don't know if we went into this. I have a nagging suspicion that maybe we had some discussion of this. Did we? No, okay. We got wave after wave of bank failures. In 1929, in October of 1929, the quantity of money in the United States was reported as approximately $26 billion. And the GDP for 1929 was about $104 billion. In 1933, the quantity of money had fallen down to about $19 billion. That's $7 billion off of $26 billion. That's more than a 25% reduction in the quantity of money. And that reduction in the quantity of money is the reflection of bank failures. The deposits of those banks had been part of the money supply, but as banks failed, their deposits lost the character of money and became junk securities, in effect. And as one set of banks would fail, reducing the quantity of money, that would serve to reduce the volume of spending in the economy, reduce sales revenues, cash flow, and the ability of those business firms to repay debt. And to the extent they owed debts to banks, more banks failed. And we could have, the process could have gone all the way to the virtual wiping out of all fiduciary media. And what I want you to be aware of is the deflationary potential of this kind of monetary system. We've spent some time developing how the expansion, how with the fiat paper money, there is tremendous potential for inflation of the money supply, the endless increase in the quantity. But it's also very important to realize that a paper monetary system, which represents claims to standard money, has the potential for deflation. The most dangerous kind of monetary system, I believe, is a gold standard with substantial fiduciary media. See, suppose you have a gold standard where the quantity of actual gold in the system is no longer the bulk of the money supply. It's a small fraction, but the whole of the money supply is payable in gold on demand. Whatever is not gold is a transferable claim to gold, payable on demand, but there is no actual gold. Well, such a money supply can be simply wiped out if it's been allowed to first expand. can be wiped out toward the gold base. And exactly this is what was happening in the early 30s. And nominal GDP, which I pointed out was about $104 billion in 1929, in 1933, it was down to $55 billion. So that's more than a 45% reduction in overall spending. Notice, not only did the quantity of money fall on the order of more than 25%, but what was implied about velocity? The velocity fell substantially as well, from something roughly about 4 in 1929, I think roughly on the order of 3 or 2.9 in 1933. Now, why would you expect velocity to fall also? People are afraid to spend. They have liabilities that they're obliged to meet. And if banks are failing and firms are failing left and right, how secure are their assets? What do you have to possess if you want to be sure to pay your bills on time?
Cash.
You have to have cash. So the demand for money for holding shoots up, and that brings velocity down. Yes, Ms. Nikolova.
Why does the Swiss banks are the most desirable banks to put your money in?
Swiss?
Yeah, the Switzerland banks. Is it only because they're not exposed to war and the war history of the country, or is it because of the velocity of the GDP?
Well, I suppose their neutrality and comparative security from war is a factor, but also importantly would be bank secrecy. You can have an account in Switzerland and they won't reveal it, but that's getting less secure. The United States government, I think, has twisted the arm of the Swiss somewhat, so one can't absolutely count on it. I think if they can claim your money is from drugs or something, maybe the Swiss will reveal it. And if they'll reveal drug money, then it's not long before they reveal tax evasion money. So I wouldn't bank on the safety of the Swiss banks. Now, what I want to briefly go into, without spending too much time on fiduciary media, is just how they come into existence, how fiduciary media are created. Yes?
I just had a quick question. Now, did you say bank premises was like the actual tangible building?
Yeah, the building, the okay. Xerox machines.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then the capital surplus, how did you define that again?
Well, the capital and surplus would be the excess of the assets over the liabilities.
Okay.
The excess of assets over liabilities.
Okay. And that's considered a liability.
The capital and surplus is shown on the liability side. That's what makes the asset and liability side balance.
Balance, okay.
Okay, now, this is figure 12.1 from chapter 12, and it's an attempt to explain how fiduciary media come into existence. And we have here a set of T accounts. These things are a kind of elongated T. We have the public in one sector and the banking system in another. And we'll imagine we have some given individual who possesses $100 in currency. And this individual will take his $100 in currency and deposit it in a bank. So this individual is going to be minus a currency in the amount of $100 and plus a checking deposit in that amount. This is item one. And if we look at that same transaction from the perspective of a bank or the banking system, the bank has an additional asset. It's plus currency in the amount of $100 and also plus a checking deposit liability in the amount of $100. So, so far, no problem. If it stopped here, the individual could now write checks up to $100 instead of spending the currency of $100. There'd be no creation of money of any kind. Under this arrangement, up to this point, the bank would be on 100% reserve. It would have claims to standard money, claims to currency, and it would have that amount of currency backing the claim. The depositor has a claim to $100, and the bank has $100. So far, it's 100% reserved. Where we start to get fiduciary media is if, and to the extent, that the bank lends out any part of the currency deposited. And let's, and that will be item two, the bank is going to lend $80. The bank is going to lend out currency, we'll assume. So it's minus currency in the amount of $80. And it receives from the borrower an IOU. And this is plus IOUs from public, $80, item two. So here we are. You go into a bank. You're going to borrow $80. You give them your IOU for $80. They'll give you currency of $80. The bank's total asset value is unchanged. And now we look at you as a member of the public. You're plus currency in the amount of $80. And you have a liability. You're plus an IOU to the bank for $80. Well, what is the amount of spendable money now? Pardon me?
The borrower or the bank?
Well, what's the total amount of spendable money in the hands of the public?
180.
Okay, I hear 180 for most people. I hear 100 from one or maybe two. Anyone still think it's 100? It's actually 180. Why is it now 180 of spendable money?
The loan of 80 plus the claim to 100.
Yeah, there's a transferable claim to 100. That's spendable money, right? And now circulating alongside of it is the 80 of currency. There's 80 of currency, and then there's a claim to 100, which is spendable money. So there's 180 of spendable money, where there used to be just 100. Now, here I've assumed that the bank has lent currency. That is not by any means the usual way they lend money. If you go and borrow money from a bank, they'll take your IOU, let's say you're borrowing $80 again, so they're going to be plus your IOU for $80. But instead of lending you $80 in currency, what they would do is create a checking deposit for you. They would say, okay, here's your $80, it's in your brand new checking account, go ahead and write checks. Okay, well the bank has $100 in currency, and what's happened to the checking deposits that the customers now have and which represents spendable money? They have that initial deposit of $100, and they have that secondary deposit of $80, which the bank has just granted. So again, there's $180 of spendable money. The banks have created $80 of spendable money. Now, imagine this process being repeated again and again and again. You see here, we have still, the bank has 100 against 180. That would be a high reserve. You'd have to imagine the banks creating more and more such deposits and getting more and more IOUs and securities and so forth until we would get to the point that they have $100 of actual money in their possession and maybe $5,000 of deposits. That would be approximately where we are today. The overwhelming bulk of the money supply is transferable claims to standard money for which the standard money doesn't actually exist. And this represents what has been called fiduciary media. And fiduciary media represent a deflationary potential. This is a part of the money supply that conceivably could be wiped out. Now, this is not to say that it actually will be wiped out or that it's very likely that it will be wiped out, but it has the ability to be wiped out. And that prospect, I think, scares the hell out of the Federal Reserve System. And so when developments start to occur that are moving in that direction, what do you think the Federal Reserve immediately does? Pardon me?
Increases the reserve. Requires more reserve.
Well, if it required more reserves, that would have the opposite effect. Because it would mean if you suddenly had to have a bigger percentage of reserves, how would you get a bigger percentage of reserves? in the absence of more reserves.
Cost of the loans.
You'd have to start calling loans, wiping out deposits. That's the opposite of what they would like. See, in the past, when banks would feel threatened that they didn't have sufficient reserves, they'd slam on the brakes against new loans. They'd want outstanding loans to be paid off as they matured. And what do you think that would do to the business firms that had to repay? Imagine you owe money to a bank, and up to now you've been getting it renewed when it comes due, or you refinance through a different bank. And now they're telling you, Joe, you owe us $50,000. We want it repaid, and we're not renewing it.
Cash flow problem.
Oh, you've got a serious cash flow problem. So you might have to have a liquidation sale. You have to raise cash somehow, liquidate your inventory, look for a buyer to buy some assets of yours. And this would be the makings of a major financial contraction. And this sort of thing happened every few years in our history, from the late 18th century down to 1933. Because what we would have is the whole boom-bust cycle. The boom phase would be the phase in which the banks are creating new and additional fiduciary media. They're enlarging the quantity of money, and they're putting it into the system through the loan market. And so long as the quantity of money is growing, the volume of spending is growing, profits are picking up, everything looks happy and rosy. But under a gold standard, there is a limit to how far that process can be carried. And as the amount of outstanding fiduciary media gets to be too large, well, then things start to happen. One of the things observed by the middle of the 19th century was the problem of the external drain, which relates to the balance of payments issue. Suppose here we are in Great Britain, the banking system of Britain is creating new and additional money, new and additional fiduciary media, which it's lending out, and business in Britain is picking up. Everything looks good. Well, as business activity in Britain starts going up, what do you think will happen to Britain's demand for imports? That will go up. And to what extent do you think people over the rest of the world are all that eager to hold British paper notes or checking deposits in London? They will not be ready to do that. Britain will have more expenditures to abroad without corresponding additional revenues. So it'll have a negative balance of payments. And how will that balance of payments be settled? If banks in Britain owe money to banks in Argentina and France and the United States, whatever, how will they be settling the balances they owe? They'll be losing gold. There'll be a drain of gold. And so that reduces their gold reserves. Now, they can stand a limited reduction in reserves if they didn't have a razor-thin margin to start with, but they can't let this go on very long. So what do they have to do to put an end to the loss of reserves? Well, they have to stop the credit expansion, start not renewing some loans, and this would precipitate the crisis. So that was recognized, but the process was repeated nevertheless over and over again. And things occurred certainly in connection with the establishment of our Federal Reserve System and World War I that allowed the process to go further than it had before, that contributed to a greater than normal expansion of fiduciary media. Setting the stage for a much bigger than normal contraction. And that bigger than normal contraction was the Great Depression of 1929. Now, a way that had been proposed in the 19th century and that had actually been enacted into law in Great Britain, there was a major piece of legislation known as the Peel Act of 1844. It was fairly well understood what the problem was, this expansion of fiduciary media, and legislation was introduced to try to stop it. And they required that the banks have 100% reserve against the issue of additional bank notes. The banks in those days were issuing their own paper currencies, and it was required by law that they have gold pound for pound against all new and additional bank notes. It wasn't understood at that time that checking deposits are as much money as the bank notes, so they failed to cover the checking deposits. But the basic idea was grasped that what would stop the boom-bust cycle was if you avoided the issue of fiduciary media to begin with. Mm. If you did create unbacked claims to standard money, if you didn't create such claims, you wouldn't have the boom phase, and you wouldn't then have the potential for the deflation depression. And my own belief is that if we had had that kind of monetary system, that would be a gold standard, but not the kind of gold standard we actually possessed, a special gold standard known as a 100% reserve gold standard, where all of the money is backed by gold. Not 25%, not 10%, not 40%, but gold, ounce for ounce, dollar for dollar. Now, with that kind of gold standard, you cannot have inflation because you can't manufacture gold ad libitum. It increases very modestly, so there's no problem of inflation. But there is also no problem of deflation. There's no way that a gold money, once it comes into existence, is suddenly going to get wiped out of existence. That problem exists when you have a fractional reserve gold standard with fiduciary media. That would be a gold standard that would be inflation proof and also deflation depression proof. The kind that we had was unfortunately very different. Yes, Mr. Boisseau.
You may have already covered this, but do any countries that you know of operate on a 100% gold standard right now?
No, not even on a fractional gold reserve standard.
Not any.
Yes, Mr. Taylor.
So you mentioned a moment ago that one way to avoid the boom bust is not to operate on this fiduciary media.
Yeah, if we didn't have fiduciary media, if we avoided the boom phase, we would avoid the bust phase.
But in reality, that's not really possible, is it? In terms of, if in fact our whole, what I'm looking at is the whole banking industry. I mean, the banking industry needs to have deposits come in, and if it was restricted to just lend out based upon, if it was restricted to the standard you just described, then they wouldn't be able to be in business.
Oh no, you could still have banking, but you see, what the banks would lend would not be the proceeds of checking deposits, they lend the proceeds of savings deposits. See, there's a big difference. When someone makes a savings deposit, he's parting with the ability to spend that money until it's withdrawn. So the bank can lend that money, and it's not adding to the money supply, it's transferring money from the depositor to the borrower. But when you put money into a checking account, you still have the right to write checks. That money is still spendable, and then the money that's lent is also spendable.
And as money market accounts, you consider that to be checking as opposed to
I think that the today's money market accounts are largely checking accounts. Now, the principle of the 100% reserve applies just to checking accounts mm-hmm. and to the issue of bank notes. It doesn't apply to savings deposits. Yes, Mr. Foster?
I'm sorry, were you suggesting that would be a good idea? Because as you're speaking, I just think that's a great target for terrorist acts.
Which?
Just to blow up all your gold, and then I would ruin your whole economy.
Okay. Now you see, it's a possible target today where there's only two holdings of gold, essentially. There's Fort Knox and the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, and they conceivably could be targets. You know, there was a James Bond story many years ago, Dr. No. I think his plan was to drop an A-bomb or something on the gold reserve, make it irradiated, so his gold holding would rise in value. Goldfinger, I'm sorry, not Dr. No. I said Dr. No. Goldfinger, forgive me. Okay. That might be a risk in today's system, but if we had a 100% gold reserve system with gold as the actual money, where would the gold be found in the country? It wouldn't be in the vaults of the Federal Reserve System or at Fort Knox. It would be in our personal possession, in the possession of millions of citizens and business firms. So it would be much less of a terrorist target. Yes, Mr. Sweeney.
Just a question. If you did do that 100% gold standard, then wouldn't you restrict the economic growth just the level that you could produce new gold?
Okay, if we did this, if we limited the increase in money to the increase in gold, and that would be modest, let's say the quantity of money would grow perhaps 2% a year, thereabouts, that would limit the growth in nominal GDP. GDP might grow only 2% a year. But that doesn't mean that production would be limited to 2% a year. What would happen if, while spending is going up 2% a year, production were going up 4% a year? Is it possible for 2% more spending to buy 4% more goods and services?
Yes.
Yeah. What would be necessary? If prices fell by the difference.
Yeah.
So it's not a limitation on physical growth. What it would mean is, instead of every year having some significant rise in prices, we would have more widely spread falling prices. To some degree, what we experience in the computer industry, where things get cheaper every year, that would be a much more common experience. You might be buying a new automobile for a little bit less than you bought last year's model. Or you spend a little less for this year's clothing than last year's clothing, perhaps. Or you could buy better clothing and whatever. Now, let me point out that we had a whole century that worked this way. That was the 19th century. I may have already said that at the end of the 19th century, prices were estimated to be a half of what they had been at the beginning of the 19th century. That's because even though we had substantial growth in money and spending, it wasn't as rapid as the increase in production and supply. And just think, what would that mean to people looking forward to retirement, for example?
It'd be great.
It would mean they wouldn't have to worry about their savings being wiped out. They could count on having somewhat greater buying power with any given sum of money from one year to the next. In today's arrangement, if you retire and you have any kind of fixed income arrangement, you're entirely at the mercy of the current government policies. If the government thinks, well, they need to boost the economy by running off a lot more money, well, here you are, you're going to end up being faced with substantially higher prices, and the buying power of your life savings will be substantially reduced.
Would that make you be like the cigarette smoker and quit smoking because you figure that cigarette's worth more tomorrow?
Well, not the... Oh, you mean the holding of if we had gold, not the present system?
Right.
Would people want to hold more money under a gold standard than they do now? They would want to hold somewhat more money. The velocity of money would be lower than it is today. The next major point I'll try to show is that a major determinant of velocity is the rate at which the quantity of money increases. The more rapidly the quantity of money increases, the less desirable is it to own such a money, and therefore it'll be spent more rapidly. The more slowly the quantity of money increases, the more desirable it is to own such a money, and it'll be spent less rapidly. The velocity will be lower. Now, and you can see this, I think, if you look at different currencies around the world. Where would you expect there to be a greater demand for money for holding? In the United States or Argentina or Mexico?
U.S.
I think in the U.S. Do you think there are many Argentines or Mexicans who are stashing away pesos in safety deposit boxes? No, because they know that in a year, even in a year, there's likely to be a substantial loss in purchasing power. Now, you might stash away dollars, but even then, you have to look forward to a loss. It would be more desirable to stash away gold, less likely to have a loss. So that's a factor, obviously, reducing velocity. But I have several different ways of developing this point that I want to go into. And this is all under the heading, the quantity of money and the demand for money. And my first point here is velocity is a reflection of the demand for money for holding. It's an inverse reflection. The less people desire to hold the money, the higher velocity. The more they want to hold the money, the lower is velocity. And what I want to develop here are these points under three, changes in the quantity of money as the cause of changes in the demand for money, and thus the velocity of money. Yes, Mr. White.
Very quick question. Is there some kind of, you know, we talked about the possession of gold and how it was at one time illegal to use it for the buying and trading of things. Is there some kind of law about the actual physical exporting of, like, currency? Like, can I just, like, get on an airplane with currency that I got from wherever it came from and just get on an airplane and try and go somewhere with it?
I don't know if there's a problem of taking currency out in any way. Supposedly, it's legal to take currency out or in any quantity, but there are reporting requirements, and I'm not sure if they apply only to bringing currency in. I know they apply to bringing currency in. I'm not sure if they apply to taking currency out. I wouldn't be surprised if they do. The cutoff amount, at least for bringing currency in, is $10,000. And if you bring in
U.S. currency,
if you bring in $10,000 or more without reporting it, without filling out some special form, it can simply be seized from you.
Wow!
And that's it. So that's pretty high-handed. Now, as I say, I'm not sure about taking the currency out. If you are planning to take more than $10,000 out, or even $10,000, I think you'd be well advised to be exactly sure what legal requirements there might be.
Okay.
Yes,
when you
Mr.
leave the country, you don't go through customs. It's
right.
Going into the
right.
whatever country you're going into. I think that would be more of the issue.
Yeah, that's where they could catch you.
Yeah.
And so that's why I say, I know when you bring it in, and perhaps since there is no exit requirement, but even today, you know, to get access to an airliner, you have to go through a security check. And I think the currency issued in the last several years may be sensitive and can be picked up. That's why they have it. They want to know, they want to be able to identify currency.
Mm.
It's one of the reasons. I shouldn't quite say that, perhaps. They say they want to distinguish it from counterfeit money.
Right.
But I think it is possible that it could be detected.
Right.
Okay, now, why should it be the case that the more rapidly the quantity of money increases, the less will be the desire to hold it, and the greater the velocity? I think there's a variety of reasons beyond the obvious one we named of what money is suitable for long-term holding. This first point is the effect of credit expansion on the prospects for borrowing. Now, a major part of the new and additional money enters the economic system in the form of loans. The banks are creating new and additional money when they enlarge their deposits. And when they do that, they're lending it out. They're creating loans. What's the effect of that, other things being equal, on interest rates?
Lowers it.
It lowers it. Now, to the extent that people develop any kind of anticipation that they can readily and profitably borrow money from their banks if they should need it, particularly businessmen. To the extent that businessmen develop the belief that as they need money for their operations, they can readily and profitably borrow it from the banks, because the banks are there generating more of it, how will that affect their perception of the extent to which they need to hold money? It'll be less. Why hold money if the money you might need, you can readily borrow? Use that money that you would have had to hold had you not been able to borrow easily and profitably. Invest that money. So now, to the extent that people reduce their cash holdings that money is spent. And if the recipients have the same kind of attitude, when they get it, they'll be operating to re-spend it that much more rapidly. So when credit expansion is going on, and people have gotten a little bit used to it, that is a factor serving to reduce the demand for money for holding and thus raising velocity. Now, a further element, if the quantity of money and volume of spending are growing, what is the effect of that on the ability easily and profitably to liquidate inventories? Pardon me? It'll make it easier. So if you are contemplating how much inventory you should hold, if in one circumstance you don't think the demand for your product is going to be rising very rapidly, maybe it won't even be rising at all, in those circumstances, you're going to hold one level of inventory. If you think the level of demand is rising and you can find more buyers for your inventory at profitable prices, well, then I think you'd be inclined to put more money into inventory rather than holding it. So that's the ability to substitute other assets for cash holdings. Now, related to that, well, closely related, the anticipation of higher prices. If you believe that if there's something you're interested in buying, but ordinarily you'd not be ready to buy it right away, you might decide, I'd like to buy this, but I'll wait to buy my new car next year. Suppose you thought that next year the price of a new car would be substantially higher than the price of a new car today. Then you'd be inclined to buy it now. So people would be induced to buy sooner rather than later. That serves to raise velocity. And then finally, there's another connection, point D, the effect of more money on the rate of interest. And this is a little bit tricky because I'm saying here the effect of more money on the rate of interest, which after a temporary drop, namely the rate of interest temporarily drops, the longer term effect is to raise the rate of profit and thus to increase the demand for and reduce the supply of loanable funds, which means raise the rate of interest. We normally assume that expanding the quantity of money, especially when it's coming into the economy in the loan market, we normally think that that lowers the rate of interest. And it does, but only temporarily. And you can see this perhaps going on even today. Why has the Federal Reserve decided to step back? I shouldn't say step back. Why have they decided to nudge interest rates up somewhat? And we'll probably do so another half point over the next several months. Why not just try to keep interest rates, the federal funds rate, down at 1%?
Because they don't want to re-elect Bush.
Slow the expansion. I suppose they didn't. I suppose they decided, well, we'll just keep creating as much new and additional reserves as is required to keep the federal funds rate at 1%. The banks have additional reserves. They'll create additional deposits. If that takes hold and starts increasing the volume of spending, which is the purpose of the policy, as the volume of spending goes up, what happens to sales revenues and profit margins?
They go up.
They go up, right? And that's one of the things that's being sought. And as profit margins rise, what happens to the rate of profit on the capital invested? That would go up too, right? Well, now, if the rate of profit that business firms across the economy, if the rate of profit that they can earn is now higher, how does that affect their willingness and ability to pay a higher rate of interest? They can afford a higher rate of interest. It's worth paying. See, the main determinant of the rate of interest, I believe, is the rate of profit. The rate of return that you can make after you've borrowed the money and have invested it. That will determine how high a rate of interest it's worthwhile to pay. If the rate of profit on capital was only 4%, that would serve to limit the rate of interest to something below 4%. If the rate of profit on capital is 6%, the rate of interest can be closer to 6%. Well, just think, the more rapidly the quantity of money and volume of spending grow, the necessary effect is to widen profit margins and the rate of profit. And that means every business firm, or almost every business firm, has the choice to use the funds in its possession. It could use them to expand its own operations, or it might lend some of them in the loan market. Now, what's going to determine the extent to which a firm will use the funds available to it for its own operations, or to lend them out, or seek to borrow funds?
Interest rate.
It's the relationship between the rate of profit they think they can make and the rate of interest they can earn or pay. So now, if the rate of profit starts to go up, how will that affect the decisions of firms as to how much money to lend out in the banking system or to other firms compared with how much to retain for their own internal use? If the rate of profit you can earn by using the funds yourself is going up, you're not going to make it as available to others unless you get a higher rate of interest. You'll need a higher rate of interest to go on supplying funds. Now, if you have a higher rate of profit, what does that do to your readiness to borrow money at a given rate of interest? You'll be more prepared to borrow. So as the rate of profit goes up, the demand for loanable funds will rise at any given rate of interest, and the supply of loanable funds will fall. The supply of loanable funds coming from business firms.
From business firms.
Not from the banks, but from business firms. Ordinary business firms. See, we have to realize business firms are themselves a major supplier of loanable funds. When business firms buy things like CDs, they're making funds available to the banking system to lend. Now, if business firms can earn a higher rate of profit on the funds, they won't be ready to buy CDs unless they can get a higher rate of interest. And they'll be ready to borrow more if they can earn a higher rate of profit. So as the quantity of money and volume of spending increase and rates of profit rise, it's virtually inevitable that interest rates will have to rise. If they didn't, if the Federal Reserve wanted to pursue a policy of holding interest rates down in the face of a rising volume of spending and sales revenues and profits, what would they have to do to how much additional money they created? What would they have to do to their rate of increase in the quantity of money? Yes, Mr. Wright, I think, is seeing where this would end. The rate of increase in the quantity of money would have to grow exponentially. See, suppose we start out, we have a low rate of profit. Say the rate of profit is 4%. And the rate of interest is pretty low, too. Imagine it's 3%. And the Federal Reserve wants to reduce interest rates. They want to make it possible for business firms to borrow at 2.5% rather than 3%. Now, they may achieve this by creating more bank reserves, encouraging the banks to make additional loans, expand the quantity of money further. And suppose they succeed in stimulating business. And now the volume of spending is growing. Will the rate of profit remain at the initial 4%?
No.
No, it's going to go higher. For the sake of illustration, let's assume it's elevated to 6%. Now, when the rate of profit was 4%, the rate of interest that the market would generate would be 3%. The Fed knocked it down to 2.5%. And they did that by bringing about some creation of new and additional money to appear in the loan market as an additional supply of loanable funds. But if the rate of profit is now 6%, how much additional money would need to be created to bring interest rates not from 3% to 2.5%, but maybe from 4.5% to 2.5%? See, because if the rate of profit were established at 6%, what kind of interest rate would that serve to generate? Do you think interest rates would be likely to stay even at 3%? They'd be tending higher than they were to begin with. And what do you have to do to lean against a developing market rate of 4.5% and to hold that to 2.5% rather than a market rate of 3% to 2.5%? That requires more expansion. And let's say they had enough expansion to do that. They have to create a lot more money to do that. What will be the effect of that on the volume of spending, sales revenues, and the rate of profit? Now maybe it's 10%. And if you're going to hold the rate of interest to 2.5% in the face of a 10% rate of profit, you'd have to be creating money hand over fist. So what happens, in order to avoid plunging the economy into hyperinflation, they really have no alternative but to allow interest rates to trail the rate of profit on up. And that's what they've already started to do in this small way, raising the federal funds rate from 1% to 1.5%, and supposedly it'll go to 2% in the near future. Because they're afraid of the pickup in business in requiring more monetary expansion if their intention is to keep the rate of interest so low. And you can see this, this is what developed over several decades. We had very low interest rates in the 1950s. They weren't low enough for many people, so they got the Fed on an expansionary course. And they kept at this, and profit rates and interest rates rose over the 50s up through the early 80s. And then they reversed course. They raised interest rates very dramatically in 1980. The Federal Reserve discount rate went briefly to 22% with a penalty rate. The federal funds rate was in that neighborhood. They very sharply cut back the rate of increase in the quantity of money. The initial effect was it suddenly appeared there's vastly less money available for lending. But it also meant there was less money available to boost sales revenues and nominal profits and to raise prices. The profit margins and the rate of profit fell, and then what do you think started to happen to the rate of interest? It started coming down. So over the longer term, the effect of an easy money policy, credit expansion, is to raise interest rates. Yes, Mr. Taylor.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I have to ask this. I'm having a hard time understanding why you keep going with higher revenues and higher profits, why that practically and tactically leads to inflation.
Because what's fueling the higher revenues and the higher profits is the expansion in the quantity of money. That essentially is the inflation. And as soon as the increase in money and spending outstrips the increase in production and supply, prices are rising. And if you're going to have new and additional money to the extent of keeping interest rates at 2.5% while the rate of profit is already 8 or 10%, well, you'd have to have stupendous increases in money offered on the loan market to keep interest rates down. But I'd very much like to go ahead into this last point here, that if we can agree that interest rates will tend to go up, the very effect of higher interest rates is further to raise velocity, to reduce the demand for money for holding. And the way this can be understood is for many, many businesses, in order to make it worthwhile to engage in a loan transaction, there has to be some minimum amount of interest to be earned. It doesn't pay to put something on the books if it'll only bring in $5 or something. Let us assume that in order for a loan transaction to be worthwhile, at least for many businesses, it has to earn a minimum amount of interest of, say, $100 before it's worth doing. Now, if the annual rate of interest is very low, say 2%, what is the shortest period of time or what would be the minimum size sum, I should say, what would be the smallest sum that it would be worthwhile to lend for a period as short as 1 week at an annual interest rate of 2% and the requirement that the loan yield you at least $100? What sum is required at a 2% annual interest rate to generate $100 of interest in 1 week?
$250,000.
It pays to lend $250,000 or more for a period as short as 1 week at an interest rate as low as 2%. That will bring in $100 or more. Would it pay to lend that $100,000 available just for a week under these assumptions? That would only bring in $40. Now, at any given time, there are various firms that have available sums of money for that they could part with for a period as short as a week. But if those sums are less than $250,000, then on these assumptions, it doesn't pay them to lend the sums. They're better off just holding them. But what if interest rates end up not staying at 2%, they go to 4%? What is the minimum size sum needed to earn $100 in 1 week at a 4% annual interest rate?
$125,000.
Now, what does that imply about the worthwhileness of lending sums available just for a period of 1 week, but less than $250,000? It's now sufficient if they're merely greater than $125,000. So all those sums in the hands of various firms that are now greater than $125,000 and less than $250,000, they were not worth lending at a 2% annual interest rate, but they are worth lending at a 4% annual interest rate. Well, what effect do you think that has on the volume of lending and spending?
Increase.
It would increase. And so what's the effect on the velocity of circulation? It would increase. So as interest rates go up, there is a tendency for short-term funds, smaller size short-term funds, funds available for shorter periods to be drawn into the spending stream. That is a further element, raising velocity. So the more rapid increase in money and spending in these four different ways serves to raise velocity. Now, Mr. Chung. Yes.
You mentioned earlier that back in the 1980s, the early 1980s, the federal fund or whatever was at 22%
or
something.
Yeah, the discount rate. Maybe I need to explain that. I didn't explain that.
Okay,
yeah.
Now, how do you explain that, or is there a relationship that you see that why would the stock market crash fail in 1989?
Why did the stock market take a big dive?
Yeah.
I don't know, it was 89 or 87. There was one
87.
There was one day the Dow Jones average opened, or was the day before, was at 2,500, and then it lost 500 points in one day. I think that the most reasonable explanation was there had been new and additional money coming into the stock market that was driving it up to 2,500. And then the Federal Reserve cut back on the expansion, and that pulled the rug out. It's the same story of the bursting of the bubble in 2000. We had this stock market bubble that was being fueled by the creation of new and additional money, much of which was going into the stock market. I think the way it worked was, imagine that you have a firm which wants to buy another firm. And perhaps they want to buy the stock of the other firm. If the financing to do that came from the creation of new and additional money, imagine they get a bank loan sufficient to buy the shares that they want. Now, stockholders in the target firm are getting an offer of cash for their shares, and we assume they accept it. What will they do with practically all of the cash they receive? They'll turn around and they'll buy other stocks. And what will the sellers of those other stocks do? They'll do it. So we have new and additional money, that most of which is racing around the stock market, kicking up share prices as it goes. And this process was continued for a while. Some of this new and additional money starts moving out of the stock market. People feel richer So some people will want to cash in part of their gains, buy the home they've been planning to buy, buy new automobiles. Some money starts draining, but that can be offset for quite a while by fresh infusions. In fact, the fresh infusions can outweigh the withdrawals, and so you can have further increases. But what happens once these increases, these further infusions of funds stop? Is there now anything left to keep driving the market up? But meanwhile, for various reasons, funds are leaving. People are cashing in on their gains. There may be companies that want to engage in physical expansion. Just think, a major asset of so many firms and individuals is the market value of their stocks. And the higher the value, the larger the number of projects, the bigger the projects you feel you can undertake. And so to the extent that firms are cashing in securities to get the money to build factories, let's say, that's taking money out of the stock market into the regular physical economy. And if the infusions are not continuing, what is there to support the stock market? You're pulling the foundation out. Plus, after the rise has been going on for a while, there's a lot of people who think the rise is just going to continue. They jump in. That fuels the rise further. But when you pull out the foundation for continuing increases, that crowd has to get out. And the money is draining away in the absence of further infusions. And so that's the basis for the collapse.
But wouldn't you think that the collapse in 1987 versus in 2000 is different? Because in 2000, it collapsed because one sector, the high-tech industry, had an overstocking inventory. And because of changing regulation in, you know, in foreign country and so forth, that now they have the unbalanced imbalance.
Well, there are always every such episode has its own unique peculiarities, but I think the basic element both times was the infusion of new and additional money, boosting the market, and then ending that process that pulled the plug on the arrangement. All right, I feel obligated to say something as much as possible now about the balance of payments doctrine. Which can be connected with the concept of the demand for money. First off, the meaning of the balance of payments and the balance of trade, these are related matters. The balance of trade is essentially the difference between imports and exports. We have exports, what we sell our goods abroad for, imports, what we're paying to bring goods in. And the balance of payments is a wider concept which incorporates all sources of receipts from abroad, not just exports, but everything. Borrowings from abroad, foreign investments, all outlays to abroad, not just imports, tourist expenditures, our lending abroad, our military aid abroad. The balance of payments includes every category of receipt from abroad, every category of expenditure to abroad. Remittances to relatives in foreign countries, gifts, loans, stock purchases, everything. Now, historically, for a very long time, these two concepts coincided in practice. Until the 19th century, there was no international capital market. The international capital market was largely destroyed for much of the 20th century. And so international economic relations for most of modern economic history were more or less confined to imports and exports. No extensive lending and borrowing for major periods. And when that was true, and it was true pretty much until sometime in the 19th century, the balance of trade and the balance of payments pretty much coincided. The only significant items were imports and exports. These concepts originated perhaps back in the 17th century, maybe even the 16th century. I refer in point two to historical origins of the concepts, mercantilism. Already by the 16th century, certainly, there were hardly any producing gold or silver mines in Europe. The gold and silver mines in Europe had been pretty much exhausted. And of course, gold and silver was the money of the time. Now, if the money supply of a country were to increase, if the gold money supply of a country were to increase in those conditions, what would be the only possible source of a country gaining gold?
Trade.
Through trade. It exports its goods in exchange for gold. When it imports, it pays in gold. And the excess of exports over imports was considered the means of obtaining an additional supply of gold. That was the only way at that time. And the excess of exports over imports was dubbed favorable on the grounds that it was the source of an increase in the supply of gold. The mercantilists were a group of authors writing on various aspects of money and trade and economic issues. And they thought it was a major goal of the policy of the country to accumulate a greater supply of gold and silver within its borders. And part of their thinking was, to the extent that a country could accumulate more gold and silver inside its territory, that would supply the government with the basis of financing military adventures outside the country. They'll be involved in a war outside the country. They'll need gold and silver to finance it. If there's a lot of gold and silver in the country, the king can then get it in taxes. And they wanted to promote economic policies designed to stimulate exports and hamper imports. So they favored tariffs on imports, subsidies to exports, for the purpose of increasing the supply of precious metals within the country. And as I say, this idea of what's favorable or unfavorable dates from that era and reflects that outlook. Now, the mercantilist outlook had some degree, at least, of plausibility under a gold standard, but under the conditions of a fiat money, it isn't even plausible because, and I think we went into this last week, suppose we have a loss of fiat money. Suppose we spend more or we send out more money in a given year than comes into the country. What is our loss? Isn't it something that can very easily be replaced?
Yep.
And we have no lack of paper money. We're increasing it at a substantial rate. The effect of the outflow of some of it is to diminish the extent of our domestic inflation. Now, so I say here, no loss in an outflow of fiat currency. And further, you should realize that most of the reported deficit, the greater part of the reported deficit, is of a fictional nature. It does not represent an actual outflow of currency. There is some, I think for reasons that I explained, but most of the deficit does not reflect an actual movement of dollars outside of the country. What it derives from is not counting a significant part of the receipts. I believe that bank deposits in the United States made by foreigners for a term of less than 6 months are not counted along with the receipts. If they were counted, the size of the reported deficit would be sharply lower. So that's the fictional nature. Now, let me point out in connection with the unfavorable balance of trade, that when a country has a so-called unfavorable balance of trade, the main source of that is likely to be foreign investment in the country. And I think a good example, which hopefully will drive home the point, try to imagine the conditions of Saudi Arabia before its oil industry was developed. Let's say they're just at the point where teams of geologists are satisfied that they've got huge oil reserves. But there's no oil wells, no oil fields there yet. They just have the oil underground. Now, what will have to be done in order to tap these oil reserves, to actually bring them out? What will they need to have coming in to Saudi Arabia? They need massive amounts of equipment, construction materials. They need a lot of foreign workers with the skills to do this. They'll need supplies of consumers' goods to support the foreign workers. Where are these things going to come from? There'll be shiploads of goods arriving in Saudi Arabia. And how must we classify these things? Are they imports? They're imports. They're imports financed by foreign investment. So Saudi Arabia will have a huge volume of imports. They could not possibly have commensurate exports. What would they have to export at that time? They have some sheep and goats, maybe. Now, is there anything, in fact, unfavorable about a country receiving a massive flow of investment goods to build up its ability to produce? No, there's a huge excess of imports over exports, but that's the foundation of the country improving. Now, I think an unfavorable balance of trade is what allows a country to import without commensurately exporting, is that foreign investors are providing the funds to pay for the imports. And that's what's making it possible. And that is true in principle of us today. We're not importing massive amounts of capital equipment anywhere, but the process is working in the same way. Japanese and Chinese investors are buying large volumes of newly issued United States Treasury securities. Now, suppose they were not present to buy these Treasury securities, and the Treasury was still issuing them. Where would the Treasury have to get the money to buy the securities? From the American economy. Now, one way would be investors would be buying the Treasury securities, but what would that stop them from doing that they're now able to do? Invest in private activity, provide funds for mortgages, provide funds for corporations. If they couldn't do that, we would have less capital available in our economy. To the extent that the Japanese and Chinese are buying the Treasury securities, the American investors don't have to, and our economy is not being stripped of its capital. So it's not that they're building up our industry, but they are preventing it from being dismantled to that extent. So it's still positive. It's nothing really unfavorable about this alleged unfavorable balance of trade. It's helping us a lot. Yes, last question. Yeah.
If that's the case, then that means that the American investors then could take part in that expansion of, like you used Saudi Arabia, right? Because now we don't have to spend the money, but we don't have to buy those CDs because that's basically foreign money being used to support our economy.
Yeah, that foreign money allows the American funds to
go stay. Out and for us to be a part of that import to those foreign countries, possibly like with Iraq, as a buildup of the Iraq starts?
Well, that's something, but I think the main element is that our own economy is not stripped of capital as it otherwise would be. The capital is available for use within our economy. And we have more goods. Notice. Let me give you this last example. Imagine Toyota sends a shipload of automobiles over here. And the automobiles are sold for dollars. Now, Toyota may want to use the part of the sales revenues that represents its cash flow. They may want to invest that in the United States. For the sake of simplicity, assume they buy long-term certificates of deposit or some kind of securities. That money stays in the United States. It finances American economic activity. The rest of the money, the rest of the dollars, Toyota will probably have to sell for yen, because they have to pay their workers in Japan and suppliers in yen. But then we have to ask, what will the sellers of the yen do with the dollars they bought from Toyota? Well, suppose if they want to invest the money here, that money is still here. We have the same amount of money remaining in the United States, the same volume of spending. What's different is we have Toyota's shipload of automobiles. We have the same spending, but more goods. That is the net gain to our economy. Okay, I don't want to keep you twice, so let me wish you all a good week. I'll see you next week.